Welcome to Valley Roundup. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. Millennials were the target of a recent column penned by a baby boomer. He says he's alarmed by the statistics, which paint a weak generation.
They don't have the physical, muscular strength of their fathers. It turns out that their unemployment rate is more than double the national average.
But a columnist who is a millennial and writes about her generation regularly has a different viewpoint.
I just think that there are a lot of really amazing millennials doing a lot to try to make a place in Aspen and to try to figure out how to make it work. And most of the people I meet my own age, I'm generally pretty inspired by.
Meanwhile, ballots are beginning to arrive in mailboxes throughout the valley, and so are the donation checks to candidates. So how much influence do supporters have over their office seekers?
You have donors on both sides that have interest in politics and in county business. What happens if one of these guys who's one of your donors, you have to take a vote on it? How are you going to handle that?
And the Democratic Party in Garfield County is hammering on a Republican candidate who is a 20-year incumbent. Finally, the race for the district attorney may also be influenced by money, but ground support is likely more powerful.
I think that in a small town, it's hard to beat knocking on doors.
Joining me this week are Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post-Independent, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, Glenn Beaton, columnist for the Aspen Times, and Aspen Public Radio's Barbara Platts. Thank you for coming in, and Randy on the phone.
Glad to participate.
Thanks for having us.
Let's just start with the elephant in the room. So I've got two columnists here. For the Aspen Times, we have Barbara Platts, who's our digital content manager at Aspen Public Radio, but she's also a columnist for the Aspen Times Weekly, and she is the focus of Glenn Beaton's column. He's a columnist for the Aspen Times that you published on Sundays, right?
Every other Sunday,
Every other Sunday. And you wrote a column this past Sunday about millennials. And, you know, there's always commentary made about the generation below whoever you're writing about or commenting about. I'm a Gen Xer. Just so for the landscape, for the listener, we've got Randy Essex on the phone. He's a baby boomer. Glenn, you're a baby boomer. Two millennials in the room with Curtis Wackerly and Barbara, and then I'm the Gen Xer by myself once again. Latchkey kid.
Too bad we couldn't have gotten a centennial in here. They're next.
Right. Yeah. So, Glenn, you looking at the comments that have been made on the Aspen Times page, there's like almost 50 comments, and you've really provoked some people, I think. So I wanted to just ask you, what's your intent with that column?
Well, let me say, Carolyn, first, I'm honored to be here, and let me tell Barbara that I enjoy your column, and I typically try to read it. With respect to the column I wrote last, which appeared on Sunday, the genesis of it was I'd been reading a number of different things in a number of different places about characteristics of what we call this millennial generation. And some of these things were a little bit disconcerting to me. You know, I read stuff that suggested that they don't have the physical, muscular strength of their fathers. They don't have as strong a hand grip as their fathers. Okay, those are sort of trivial things, but they might be indicative of something else too. It turns out that their unemployment rate is more than double the national average. The most common living arrangement for millennials is to live at home with their parents. And it just kind of goes on and on with these things that kind of leave you with the impression that there's a generation that's struggling to grow up. Now, having said that, by the way, this is all not statistics I made up. It's from sources like the Pew Research Center. A number of the studies were reported in the Washington Post. Some of it's from the Census Bureau. And nobody has actually taken issue with the statistics I've cited. But it has hit a nerve, for sure. A number of people seem to have taken it in a personal way, as if I was describing them. And the reaction has been, well, wait a minute, I don't live with my mom in the basement, and I'm not unemployed, et cetera, et cetera. There was a letter to the editor recently that said that Glenn Beaton is the real wimp, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm not the issue here. I'm honored that you want to make me the issue, but you know, really we're talking about the millennial generation. Now, and you know, having said that, there's so many exceptions. These are generalizations, and as I said in the column right at the outset, you know, I'll quote what I said. These facts are necessarily generalizations. There are, of course, exceptions. Well, but a lot of people really did take it personally and felt that I was either insulting them personally or insulting their tribe, and they were angry and hurt about that, and so I got some sort of vitriolic responses.
Well, there certainly was some banter in my newsroom where there's quite a few millennials, and yeah, they did take it personally. Barbara, did you take it personally? I mean, as a columnist, you came back with some pretty, I think, poignant, you know, points to him, his arguments.
Yeah, I think the reason that maybe it struck such a nerve is, you know, I have a Google alert on that for millennials because I'm always looking for column fodder. But every day I look through all these articles online and it's just bashing us every step of the way. So I kind of think it's just the straw that broke the camel's back for some people, I think, that commented. I think for me, I just one of my goals with my column, which is how I pitched it 3 years ago, is I want to kind of give a showcase to what millennials are up to. And sometimes I profile them, or sometimes I just like to share what a nonprofit's up to. Sometimes they're just silly columns I do, admittedly. But I think I just think that there are a lot of really amazing millennials doing a lot to try to make a place in Aspen and to try to figure out how to make it work. And most of them, I guess most of the people I meet my own age, I'm generally pretty inspired by, as opposed to... So you definitely have your quintessential ski bumps, but I think we've done a good job, and I think it's just we get a lot of these insults, and maybe part of the reason is the media is bigger than it's ever been. We have the ability to study more than we ever have, so this is probably the most studied generation thus far. But just every day there's an article coming out, and I think it kind of just after a while just like give us a chance, you know, like yeah. We're working on it.
I mean, you were the subject of your generation was the subject of a Saturday Night Live skit that was just. Brilliant and went viral. And so, Curtis, I'm looking at you. Do you have an opinion?
I got
about
something
this?
To He's say. He's a millennial. I'm the oldest millennial, right? Depending on how you categorize it. I don't know that I would say I took the column personally. I felt that it was trying to make an argument by purposely trying to put forward the worst possible case you could make for millennials, and that in doing so, it failed to see what I think are some of the most critical points and some of the things that make this generation really unique. I mean, it is a really unique generation. For one, no generation has been left with so little by a generation preceding us that had so much.
Does that sound like whining to you, Randy or Glenn?
But let's think about this for a minute. We're coming off the worst recession since the Great Depression. We have 30 years, basically, of stagnant wages. We've watched systems collapse around us politically. I mean, look at a lot of us came of age in the 2000 election, which was basically a failure of democracy, followed up with 9/11 and the economic crash. I mean, there's all these factors that you have to consider. And, I don't know who all these millennials are that live with their parents. I don't know any of them. Most of the people my age I know strive very hard and are, it's an extremely creative generation, I would say. We have more information available to us than any generation has ever had before. We're probably the most well-traveled generation. I mean, it's a very different group, and there's been nothing like this before.
As I said in my column, they're too troublesome to care for and too cute to drown.
Well, and it's funny, you know,
she is pretty cute. You wouldn't want to drown her.
And, I think it's funny when people do say, like, geez, millennial, you're always in your iPhone or you're always on Facebook. But that's actually my job here at Aspen Public Radio. I have to be on my phone and on Facebook because I'm interacting for the sake of the radio. So it's kind of that our jobs have switched to more tech-oriented in that way. We're not probably as physically strong as we used to be, but the job market's changed so much.
And what did you write about how they are in the workplace, the millennial generation?
Well, there's not a lot of hard data about that, and so I tried to avoid it. You know, the stereotype is that they're very demanding, they want to be coddled, they don't want to work hard, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a hard thing to really find hard data about, and so I didn't go there. You know, right. I don't want to jump in there
because as a boss of millennials in Detroit and Cincinnati and here in Glenwood Springs, I haven't found at all that millennials don't work as hard as anybody else. And I haven't found at all that millennials You know, Glenn, you wrote a lot about the work-life balance, and I've got a baby boomer on my staff who says, why isn't the life-work balance? You know, he wants to be on his bike and be running and be here as only as much as necessary. I mean, my experience in all these workplaces, and I also have a son who's 29, who I think has a really good work ethic, is that millennials can be counted on to take on responsibility. They, in fact, want to be given opportunities and aren't really afraid to take ownership. I think a big difference among millennials and my generation is that millennials don't have the myth that their employer is going to be loyal to them, which I think is probably pretty smart. That might have been the case a generation ago. That might have been the case. I think it is not a character flaw to recognize that if you're in an entry-level job, you're probably not getting paid very much. I mean, to Curtis's point about low wages and wage stagnation. And by the way, it was the greatest generation that instituted tax cuts that have led to that wage stagnation and also led to my defined benefit pension being frozen in 2008. So,
which we'll never sniff, you know, a defined benefit
program. My experience with millennials in the workplace is that they'll work really hard for you, and they might leave tomorrow. I think that that's not a character flaw. I think that that is, in some ways, a realistic assessment of how to learn and seize opportunities. Now, you know, 10 years from now, if you've only worked someplace for a year and a half at a time, you know, that might create some issues. I also think there's a tremendous myth that older people can't be digitally savvy and, you know, I think that some of these generalizations are true of both boomer, of any generation, but individually they don't ring out. Glenn did write one thing, taught from a young age that they are special and raised in relative luxury. That's the truth.
Yeah, I'll give Glenn that one.
I read up on my generation, Gen X. You know, we were supposed to be, you know, in our 20-somethings, we were unfocused and bleak and cynical and disaffected.
Let me just give a few personal examples, some of which support the points being made, I think. I'm a father, too. I have two millennial children, grown children, and I'm immensely proud of them. I could not be more proud of them, and I'm not just saying that. Also, something that came up in social media was pretty interesting. Someone took issue with my column, and there was some back and forth on it that I observed for a while until I weighed in. He was defending millennials and telling me that I was being, I think his phrase was, a grumpy old man. And I'll give Barbara that one, too, since she gave me one. I am a grumpy old man sometimes. This guy, though, when he was a member of Mountain Rescue and when I was, too, I had a heart attack climbing Ajax once, running up Ajax trying to set a personal record. He was on the advanced team of Mountain Rescue, and he may well have saved my life by getting to me as fast as he got to me. And as I said when I finally weighed in on this exchange in Facebook, if I were in a jam, he'd probably be my very first guy that I'd want to help me out of the jam. As to the point that millennials had a lot to contend with. They came of age at about the time of the financial crisis. That's true. But, you know, every generation has a lot to contend with. The financial crisis of 2009 was not as bad as the Great Depression that my father came of age in and that my mother came of age in. They inherited a Great Depression that was not of their making. They inherited World War II that was not of their making, where 350,000 of them went overseas and died. You talk about traumatic stress syndrome, you know, you'd think that that was invented in the Iraq War. Can you imagine what people saw and what they lived with for the rest of their lives and their dreams after World War II and the Vietnam War? The baby boomers inherited the Vietnam War. 55,000 of them died. That's 10 times as many as have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's not to take anything away from the people who died in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're just as dead. But my point is that every generation has its things to contend with that aren't its fault.
I posted your column on my own page to get some insight from millennials, like, hey, tell me what you guys think. And Christina King, the founder of the Aspen Strong Foundation, who's also a millennial, was writing how there actually is in our generation, and I said, you know, I'm going to shoot you an email, let's get coffee next week because I want to hear more about this, but there is a whole failure to launch conference around the idea that the millennials, although everybody, every generation has had these catastrophes, had these horrible things happen, that we're the first generation that has seen, been able to click on it all. And just, it just takes three clicks on my phone and I can see videos of people jumping off the World Trade Center, you know, like, so I think it's kind of interesting that, I don't know, I want to talk to her more about it, but that because we've had all this visual stuff, that we painted this picture of how the world is, and it's kind of, it is scaring some of us to get out there, which I thought was an interesting take on it.
You are listening to Valley Roundup, an analysis and commentary of the week's news with writers and editors. I'm Carolyn Zachariasen. We now continue our conversation about the merits of the millennial generation.
There's no arguing Glenn's point that millennials are delaying marriage, having kids, and buying a home. That's clear. And that is certainly an interesting phenomenon. It's shaping our world in a lot of ways. I mean, if you think about all the arguments about how slow growth is in this country, you think if millennials start having babies, maybe they would see the GDP numbers start to shoot up. But for a number of reasons, most people of this generation are waiting on that, because my suggestion is that they don't really feel secure in their, you know, in their careers and their financial stability, and they're, you know, they don't really want to jump off that diving board until they feel a little more secure. And there's probably 1.5 million reasons for that, but it is a very interesting phenomenon.
I do think a big part of that is student debt, which is, I mean, I have people working here who have student debt that I cannot fathom. I finished my undergraduate studies with something like $2,500 or $3,000 in student debt.
Right. It's like one semester's worth of student debt.
Right? And I think that it's absolutely right that, I don't know if that would be part of the discussion in the presidential campaign. Were it not for Bernie Sanders, Obama took a couple of steps regarding interest, but it is a ridiculous cost of education that, you know, it affects the economy. You can't buy a car, just for example. And buying a car is a very important piece of the economy because the auto industry has a tremendously long tail. All the things that go into a car, making it, servicing it, so forth, you know. Even if you could afford a house here, well, it exacerbates housing all over the country. The kinds of housing that you can choose, having to double up with people.
We've just lived in this hyperinflationary bubble for our entire lives, and our own ability to make a living is not kept up with it.
You mentioned that we're not just in student debt, I believe, in your column, and I haven't had enough time to research that. Did you look at all if we're very... Are we,
on credit card debt? Yeah, I did specifically look at credit card debt, and that's not a compelling case. But the most recent thing I saw, I think was in Forbes, was that actually they do carry pretty high credit card debt, higher than other age groups.
I think it's interesting, like, because, well, and it's a little vague, the definition of what a millennial is, but it's roughly, you were born between 1980 and 2000. So I think it'll be interesting as we all get to the point of adulthood, you know, like into our 30s, and how this will change. And I assume maybe our parents' basements will become our own houses by then. But I think it'll be interesting to see kind of how we evolve as a generation and how the one beneath us does as well.
You had said in your response to your column about how it was about the weak factor. We didn't grow up in a world of industrialized era where you had to lift heavy things. Now we're more technologically savvy.
Yeah, that's our currency. That's how we get jobs.
So you just need to be able to pick up an iPhone or a Samsung.
Yeah, and Randy has a good point, that adults know that stuff too, or the older generations. But every job I've had, and before that, you know, even in school, if there's a technological problem, you always look at the younger kids. Well, do you know what's wrong? Well, no, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't know how to fix the printer. I really don't have but it's kind of assumed that we know these things.
Right.
You know, you mentioned actually on the show here that baby boomers are staying in the workplace longer, making it harder to get jobs. And part of that has to do with us suffering the same economic misfortune that you did with the recession. As I said, you know, my defined benefit pension for a company I worked for 25 years was frozen in 2008. And, you know, that significantly, plus I was cast into the self-managed, self-financed 401k, which suffered during the recession too. So we were all in that mess together.
Could I just say one thing to kind of wrap up this
Sure.
topic before we go to the next one? Let me say first that I was whining, even I whine sometimes, earlier about people taking the column personally. I have to give myself some of the blame for that. I write in a provocative way. I figure that if person's not reading my column, then I may as well not be writing it. So the number one thing always has to be to get a reader. And sometimes to get readers, you have to be a little bit provocative, sometimes even overstate things a little bit. I'm not a newspaper reporter. I'm a columnist, okay? So I'll take some of the blame for that.
I recently told Glenn in an email that he's my favorite provocateur among my columnists.
Why is that?
Yeah, he's just, he pokes people intentionally. He's trying to kick up dirt.
I think provocateur is a French word for right? The other thing is, you know, there's a comparison between the baby boomers versus the millennials versus the Generation X's and so on and so forth. You know, I think that all that comparison vanishes when you compare any of them and all of them to my parents' generation, the greatest generation. They really pulled us through it. They were tough hombres.
Moving on to the local politics scene, there's so few people trying to earn our vote.
Or buy it.
Or buy it, right. So, Curtis, you did a story about campaign finance reports for the Picken County Commissioner race. They've raised quite a bit of money. And during the debate that Aspen Public Radio hosted on Tuesday night, I brought that fact up to one of the candidates. You know, I said, one of your top donors has got business in front of the county. In fact, you've got two donors, one that's been sideways with the county, on a trail along Castle Creek.
That's proposed to be built, right?
Right. You know, he said that he would recuse himself if it was something that was necessary at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder, you know, if anybody have any thoughts about how donors connect to, on a local level, how they're influenced.
Well, we're looking at the commissioner race with Scott Ryder and Greg Poschman, and I looked through all their campaign finance reports going back since the primary election started in the winter and the spring, and you have donors on both sides that have, you know, that have interest in politics and in county business, and so the question that you raised is, what happens if one of these guys who's one of your donors, you have to take a vote on it? How are you going to handle that? He gave probably the right answer, which is, well, you have to consider it very carefully and recuse yourself if you must.
The reason that it's required mm-hmm. to disclose your mm-hmm. donors is for that reason, just so that
right.
the public knows who that they may be influenced from and who may have, what their motivations may be.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Poschman has some higher donors than Scott does.
He has more. His list of donors has lots of, he's got the John Doerr on there. He's got some of these bigwigs who are, you know, millionaires and billionaires and very successful tech entrepreneurs that own homes here. And he's managed to attract them into his camp. Scott also, interestingly enough, has a donation from one of the Walmart grandkids. He also has, this is something I found really interesting. I'm looking through the reports and there's a donation from Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's LLC. And I immediately picked up the phone and called the county and said, you can do this? I didn't realize that corporations could make donations to individual political campaigns. But it turns out you can. Corporations are people under election law. The list of donors, I think, tells you something about a candidate. It tells you who's supporting them in ways that the other things don't.
Yeah, Randy, you did a story about the DA's race, and the Republican candidate has far outraised his opponents, right?
Not surprisingly. That's a fascinating race. I'm not entirely sure that money will be the deciding factor, but yeah, Jeff Cheney, the Republican, had raised more than $15,000, and Sherry Kaloya, the Democrat, was at 4,300. The independent Chip McCrory, who we endorsed, is a little over 6,000.
What do you think has more influence? Work on the ground, letters to the editor, or money?
I think that in a small town, it's hard to beat knocking on doors. I think I saw in the school board race last year, there was an early rush of letters to the editor for a woman in Snowmass Village or Snowmass that I think raised her name recognition an awfully lot in a race that, you know, typically doesn't get a lot of attention. And Carl Hanlon, who was serving a vacancy, he was filling out a term on the board and running for re-election, was late to get started, and we got a few letters late, but I think he just got swamped by that. So I do think that personal connection and letters to the editor can make a lot of difference in places this size. Of course, money can buy you a lot of yard signs, but I just feel like the retail person-to-person politics is really important.
I think word of mouth has a lot to do with it in a small town, and who your backers are, what their standing is in the community, what sort of influence they have over their circles of friends. Because I think most people form their political opinions based on those of the people around them.
And I think that's a good thing. You know, democracy, I think, still works relatively well in a small town. I'm not opposed to the money being involved, but I think people ought to really pay very close attention to the money and ask themselves whether there's a connection. The media bears some responsibility here, too. If a newspaper just shows a list of donors to a given candidate with no indication of who they are or what they stand for, what their business is, that's not very informative to your average person unless he just happens to know. I think it's incumbent on the media to point out in the article, John Doe just happens to have this kind of business, and, you know, that people connect the dots. But give them the dots to connect.
I do notice that with Poshman and Ryder. I feel like whenever I stop to get a coffee somewhere, they're having coffee with someone, mm-hmm. they're meeting with someone. Especially I've noticed that with Ryder, they're very good at getting the word out. And I think that's something that's wonderful about a small town, that you can do that and it makes a difference.
Randy, do you want to quickly hit on the Garfield County race?
It has become quite the thing with the Democrats. I thought went on a fishing expedition with 19 open records requests to the county, seeking receipts and minutes to past meetings and so forth. And they ultimately discovered some spending that John Martin had to reimburse that hadn't been disclosed, which was really interesting. Then discovered that it's within policy. He's been billing the county for lunches that he has on Mondays with another county commissioner, because the commissioners meet on Mondays, and they meet in the morning and they meet in the afternoon. I've seen him, and I've teased him about being a quorum on the three-member board without thinking that, gosh, they're billing that to the county. And, okay, it's within policy, but I think it looks bad to the ordinary person. I think that despite this stuff with Martin, which in an editorial today I say really points to his hubris, it's being shrugged off by Republicans. As local campaigns go, there's a lot of smoke and fire here. I don't think it's going to change the outcome.
Okay. Thank you very much for taking the time and coming in here for the first time, Glenn.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
That was Glenn Beaton, columnist for the Aspen Times, Randy Essex, editor and publisher of the Glenwood Post Independent, Curtis Wackerly, editor of the Aspen Daily News, and Aspen Public Radio's Barbara Platts. I'm Carolyn Sakariasen, and you've been listening to Valley Roundup. You can also get a rundown of links and more information on the stories covered on this show on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.